This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much for being with us today. And we're going to spend some time outside the United States today with news out of Turkey and Cuba. But first, we go to the Korean Peninsula because South Korea's government and President Trump have confirmed something that seemed impossible as recently as last month, a meeting between the president and Kim Jong-un and talks to formally end the nearly 65-year-old state of war in Korea.
I look forward to meeting with Kim Jong-un, and hopefully that will be a success. We've also started talking to North Korea directly. We have had direct talks at very high levels, extremely high levels. We have not picked a site yet, but we've picked five sites where it's potentially going to be. South Korea is meeting and has plans to meet with North Korea to see if they can end the war, and they have my blessing on that.
President Trump also confirmed on Wednesday that CIA Director and Secretary of State nominee Mike Pompeo recently met with Kim Jong-un to lay the groundwork for Trump's own meeting sometime in May or June. The news is sprouting optimism, cautious optimism, all over Asia and the United States. Still, that cautious part is evident even for President Trump, who wants a big deal, but is also known to quickly change his mind on what a deal looks like.
If I think that it's a meeting that is not going to be fruitful, we're not going to go. If the meeting when I'm there is not fruitful, I will respectfully leave the meeting.
North and South Korea are preparing for their two presidents to meet on April 27th. The South Korean government says the goal of that meeting should be a peace treaty. Well, is that overly optimistic, a peace treaty? What would a formal end to hostilities on the Korean Peninsula look like? Tim Shorrock is a journalist who's been covering the Korea since the 1970s. He's also a correspondent for The Nation. Tim, welcome.
Thank you.
Look, what do we know about these talks between South and North Korea right now and what the real goal is?
The real goal is to get a peace process going in Korea that ends the Korean War, gets a peace treaty, and moves to a position where North Korea can normalize its relationships with the United States and end its nuclear program. And they've been talking about this for weeks now, and I think this is a momentous event coming up in South Korea.
Well, why is this all happening now? What do you think is driving this behind the scenes?
Well, what drove it was, you know, obviously last year, as we know, the North Koreans tested, 11 or 12 missiles, and they have an ICBM capable of hitting the United States, and they also have nuclear weapons. They haven't quite placed those nuclear weapons on an ICBM that can travel through the atmosphere and hit a target in the United States yet, but they're close. But the point is, at the end of the year last year, they stopped their tests before they reached that full nuclear capability and signaled that they were ready to talk. And so I think they feel like they're going into any negotiations with the U.S. from a position of strength. And on January 1st, Kim Jong-un made a declaration, made a speech where he said to the South Koreans he wanted to engage again. And Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, immediately followed that up. And they had the most high-level negotiations, since the end of the Korean War after that. And they've been laying the groundwork for these upcoming talks that begin next week. And I think those talks are going to lay the groundwork for the Trump-Kim summit later in May or early June.
You know, Tim, we tell ourselves all the time here in the United States that a tough approach to North Korea can yield fruit in terms of negotiations. If you get tough on them, they'll come to the table. You're suggesting quite the opposite. You're suggesting maybe that North Korea and Kim Jong-un, through its nuclear testing and missile testing, got pretty tough and made it clear that the South and maybe the United States should come to the table.
I think that's absolutely true. And, they said, they've been saying for years what they want. They're building their nuclear weapons as a deterrence against the United States. And so they wanted to at least have the capability to have that deterrence in the sense of hitting U.S. bases. What they have now, they could easily hit U.S. bases in Japan and Okinawa and South Korea. So they wanted that deterrence, wanted to come in with that. But I do think that the sanctions have definitely played a role here, the very heavy sanctions imposed by the United States as well as the United Nations. They may not be stopping or slowing down their rocket or missile or nuclear program there, but they've certainly beginning to pinch the North Korean economy. And one of the things that Kim Jong-un has said over and over again is that he wants to you know, he wants to start focusing on building the North Korean economy. So I think, you know, getting, you know, they're very anxious to lift these sanctions.
Tim, China and the United States are both intimately involved here, not just politically, but are both parties to the initial war declaration and to the armistice. So China and the U.S. would both have to sign off here, right? There are increasing trade tensions between China and the United States now. Can you connect those tensions to what might happen if we go around a couple corners on the Korean Peninsula?
I actually don't think the trade tensions with China will play much of a role here. I think China's quite committed, wants a peace process to begin and wants, you know, a settlement of the issues on the Korean Peninsula, regardless of what happens on trade. And I think that actually what happened over the last year, and especially with Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, playing such a prominent role in this diplomacy, is that actually, you know, the U.S. kind of wanted China to play a big role in getting North Korea to get into a negotiating mode. But actually, it was South Korea that played that mediator role. And actually, it's going to be South Korea that's going to be mediating between the United States and North Korea as opposed to China. So, you know, China's kind of watching this from the sidelines, which is why, of course, they invited, you know, Kim Jong-un to visit China a couple of weeks ago, because they wanted to make sure they were on, you know, they had a clear idea of what was going to happen. They were in agreement with what should happen. But I do think that it really is South Korea's president, Moon Jae-in, who's primarily responsible for this major shift.
So, Tim, let's talk about incentives here before we go. Does peace with the South really mean peace with the United States, though, from the perspective of North Korea? I mean, opposing the American invader, fighting the aggressor, all of that has been pretty critical propaganda and a major pillar of the structure of the North Korean regime. Would they give it up?
Well, they say they're willing to denuclearize, and they're willing to talk about denuclearization issues. But I think, you know, on the other side, we have to look at, you know, they've been wanting the U.S. to end its hostile policy. I mean, the United States has had, you know, had until 1991, had nuclear weapons in South Korea, pulled them out, but they've got nuclear weapons, you know, all over in their region, in Japan, in Okinawa, and in Guam. And so, you know, North Korea sees that as a threat. So I think, you know, both sides need to come to the table with an idea of ending the enmity between them. And I think that's what's very possible here.
Tim Shorrock, correspondent for The Nation, longtime observer and journalist covering the Koreas. Tim, great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Let's move now to what a possible peace treaty could mean for families who were split between North and South during the Korean War. Catherine Killow is a fellow at the Plowshares Fund and a young Korean American who's advocated for peace between North and South. And I asked her how different generations in Korea are feeling about these latest developments.
I don't want to paint the South Korean public with a broad brush. I think it's really split among ideological lines, party affiliations. I can speak for my mother's generation, and I would say my mother's family comes from a more blue-collar Korean upbringing. And for her, this is a really emotional and personal issue. So you could put her in the idealistic, optimistic camp. On the other hand, there are, for good reason, plenty of Korean families who are extremely skeptical. They're accustomed to these gestures. There have been talks of reunifying families in the past that have fallen through, or, you know, only a small nominal amount of families were able to meet. So it's definitely split, and it's not an easy question to answer in any simple way. And I think that also goes with, you know, when you look at the young Korean generations and how they feel about this whole initiative.
We'll talk about younger people in South Korea, in North Korea, if you can. I mean, we've had other analysts on this show who've suggested that with all the fire and fury between North Korea and the United States, that a lot of younger people in South Korea in particular aren't terribly engaged with this conflict and with the North. They kind of go about their lives, and it is a generalization, but they don't think about it much.
Based on my own assessments and personal conversations I've had with friends who are my age in Korea, I'd say it is largely the case that young people there are more skeptical than they are jazzed about a peace treaty or any sort of engagement effort with North Korea. But I don't believe that's coming from a place of hate or aversion toward North Korea as it is indifference. These are people who have been living their whole lives accustomed to the reality that is a nuclear North Korea that's provocative from time to time, has a rather colorful leader. And that being said, there's still this powerful sense of familial attachment and identity as one people. So, you know, I think there are a lot of legitimate anxieties that the youth have towards North Korea, but at the same time, it's just so complicated by this idea that, you know, the people on the other side of the border are still your brothers and sisters.
Well, what about you, Catherine? You're a young Korean-American, part of the diaspora. How do you feel about the end to the state of war and a potential peace treaty now?
I'm extremely encouraged by it. For me, it's helpful to frame this idea of a peace treaty as the start to a process. And to see it, you know, I think there is a tendency to view peace treaty as reunification. But that's not the case, because this is actually just a commitment to end hostilities and to actually move forward on an issue that has divided the country arbitrarily for nearly a century.
Still, I mean, you hear President Trump just yesterday saying, if these talks aren't fruitful, I'll walk away. It seems like everybody, even President Trump, understands the fragility of what's going on here.
Definitely. But I think President Trump is also the type of president who really wants a victory. So I'm actually more optimistic that no matter what happens at the summits, he is going to consider this a win. And maybe he'll just leave it at that and let the negotiators take control. But in any case, this is a better outcome than what we've been doing previously.
Catherine Killo, a young Korean-American and a fellow at the Plowshares Fund. Catherine, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.